From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, more of our favorite recent interviews. We'll hear from Larry David. He spoke with Dave Davies about co-creating Seinfeld, the difference between his own personality and the character he played on Curb Your Enthusiasm, and his experiences starring in his own Broadway play.
It's not so easy, Dave. First of all, it's a lot of pressure. You know, you got to make 1,000 people laugh every night with a script. It's not like doing stand-up.
Also, writer Chris Offit talks about being the son of a pornographer. Offit's late father wrote and published over 400 books, the vast majority of which were pornography.
Ghosts, zombie porn, porn set in Atlantis, porn on alien planets with barbarian cultures, vampire porn, pirates.
Offit's father thought of himself as an artist and pioneer in the field, and porn paid the bills. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
This episode of Fresh Air and the following message come from Framebridge, who make beautiful custom framing easy. They've reinvented the framing experience so you can finally frame your favorite art and photos without a hassle. Place your order at framebridge.com by selecting from a curated collection of frame styles, then mail them your art. They'll send free packaging for the shipping, or upload a photo for them to print and frame. Your framed art arrives at your door beautifully framed and ready to hang. Go to framebridge.com and use promo code NPR for 15% off your first Framebridge order.
I can't imagine what it would be like if my father had been a pornographer. So I read with fascination what it's like for writer Chris Offit to be the son of a pornographer. Offit is the author of a forthcoming memoir called My Father, the Pornographer, which was excerpted in early February in the New York Times Magazine. We're going to hear the interview I recorded with him in March as we continue our end-of-summer series featuring some of our favorite recent interviews. Chris Offit is known for his fiction and literary memoirs. His father was known by his 17 pen names, under which he wrote nearly 375 porn books. He also wrote 2 science fiction and 24 fantasy novels. His first porn book was published in 1968, and in 1970, he shut down his small insurance agency, thinking porn would be more profitable. The timing was right, with the sexual revolution expanding the market. His readers probably wouldn't have guessed that he wrote from his home in Kentucky in what Chris Offit describes as a hill and holler community, a zip code with a creek. While Chris was growing up there, the source of his father's income was a family secret. In 2013, when Chris was 54, his father died and left Chris with the inheritance of thousands of letters and tens of thousands of novel pages. Chris moved back to his childhood home for several months to sort through the papers and assemble a bibliography. By the way, this interview is not explicit about porn. It's really about the father. Chris Offit, welcome to Fresh Air. You write that your father considered himself the class operator in the field of pornography. What was he known for in the field?
Well, I'm not really sure. There hasn't been a great deal of scholarship on the field of pornography to separate out what one writer was known for with another. Dad believed that he had introduced various anatomical descriptions into pornography that had not been there before. He also believed that he had introduced the fact that a female could derive a great deal of pleasure, then that had not been seen in pornography before. At the same time, it's hard to know if that was true or not. The point, though, is that Dad believed it, and he thought he was a very good writer. And the other reason for that was that he believed that other porn writers were copying his style and some of these pioneering uses of anatomical language regarding sexuality.
So your father initially was selling insurance, and he quit his job to help raise money for things like your orthodontia, your braces, and he became a team with your mother who typed the manuscripts. What a huge shift in the family to go from this, like, very secure kind of job to writing pornography and having your mother type it. I mean, was she comfortable even reading what he was writing?
Oh, yeah. She was part and parcel from the beginning. He was a successful businessman in sales, but wasn't happy. He'd always written since he was a child and wanted to write. But at age 36, he had 4 kids and a mortgage. And I needed orthodontic care, and all of my siblings and me were in school, so Mom had suggested that she get a job outside of the home to pay for the dental care, and Dad didn't want to do that, so they just hatched this plan, and it took me a couple of years to realize that it seemed like Dad was writing this. But I did not know that Mom was actually typing all of his final manuscripts for submission to the publishers. She could zip through it. I would come home from school, would walk through the woods along a little path, enter the house to the sound of two typewriters simultaneously clattering away. It was an unusual circumstance. But I knew Dad was a writer. I just assumed that it was science fiction.
To give us more of a sense of what your father wrote, can you name some of the titles of some of his books?
Sure. Be happy to do that. I should also tell you that the book is dedicated to 17 people, all of or 18 people, all of Dad and all of his pseudonyms.
That's hysterical.
Yeah. Well, it seemed to make sense. Okay. Well, the first one was called Bondage Babes. And in 1968, he published five. Bondage Babes, Swapper Town, Sex Toy, Gang Swap, and The Seductress. Bruise, which I believe to be his best porn novel. The one that Dad thought was the best was called Mongol with an exclamation point. I've never been... he had 12 or 14 books that had exclamation points in the title, so I'm not sure how to pronounce it. Mongol, maybe. Mongol! Fruit of the Loin... The Devoured is Vampires in New York City, not a bad book. I could keep on going. I mean, there's a lot.
So I don't know if any of the stories are radio-friendly that your father told in his fiction, but is there one that would give us a sense of the kind of story that he dreamed up?
Radio-friendly? One that I enjoyed the most, these two couples crash-landed on a deserted island, but come to find out the island wasn't deserted. After all, it was just unexplored. The middle of the island had a volcano. On the other side of the volcano lived a primitive culture that would drop virgins into the volcano to sacrifice to the gods for good weather and good luck, right? Now, the other side, where they crash-landed, was occupied and inhabited by all the virgins who'd managed to escape from the other side of the volcano. So you can imagine then what went on after the plane landed, crash landed, and everybody survived. It's pretty interesting. Like one of the guys goes native and one of the guys doesn't, and there's some morality in there and great concerns about impacting on this culture that had not been westernized or anything.
The way pornography often works in families is that parents, if they read pornography, hide it from their children, and the children who read pornography hide it from their parents. So how did the conversation in the family get open? Did they tell you about the porn, or did you confront them with the fact that you suspected that this is what they were doing?
Neither. There was no official formal conversation where this is what we're doing and you should know or anything like that. It was a maintained secret as much as possible. Part of it was just living in a small community and a conservative community in the hills of Kentucky. But it wasn't until I was out of the house and in my 20s that Dad became more forthcoming about his pornographic work. My understanding prior to that had been he was a functioning science fiction writer, and the pornography was generating supplemental income.
You read that when you found, you know, that after your father died and you went through his books, you found that he had a cataloging system for writing pornography, that he had whole sections ready to go into like kind of cut and paste in the appropriate book. So we had pages with like 150 synonyms for pain. There were sections for descriptions of the mouth, for descriptions of the tongue, the face, the legs, for kisses, spanking, distress. So it sounds like you cataloged all of this and had it all ready to paste into the appropriate book, and then he'd kind of exit out of the catalog so he wouldn't use it a second time. I've never heard of somebody writing that way before.
Me neither. It was a remarkable discovery. In addition to what you described, there were also pages and pages like that of descriptions for the science fiction and for the fantasy, pages of description of landscape or of a storm or of a night sky. And what he did is he would watch television at night with a big clipboard and write longhand. And we would all be sitting there watching television. Dad was writing. We were kids. And I realized later that this was what he was doing at that during those hours. He wasn't writing a novel or a short story, but he was just inventing descriptions while watching television. He liked to watch TV and write. I was quite taken by this approach. He was working at a great speed and under enormous pressure, not deadline pressure, but just economic pressure. You know, there were rarely contracts for these books in advance, you know, but he had to support his family, and he wrote one book in 3 days. His personal record was 94 pages in a single day. And the system that he devised reminded me of an assembly line of a car factory where you just have all the raw material and you just drop it in place as it goes down the assembly line, and at the end there's a car. I have never met another writer who worked with this technique, and it was extensive. There are a lot of these notebooks, Terry.
My guest is writer Chris Offit. He's writing a memoir about his father, who wrote hundreds of porn novels under pseudonyms, including the name John Cleave. I'm wondering how your parents told you about the facts of life. I remember my mother giving me one of those books that are all about, like, the animals and the insects, mm-hmm. and with, like, a quarter of a page mm-hmm. about the humans. mm-hmm. But, I mean, considering that your father was so obsessed with sexuality mm-hmm. and that he was writing the porn, your mother was typing the manuscripts, mm-hmm. How did they tell you? How did they break the news? Or maybe you already knew.
I never had a conversation with my mother along these lines. There were two boys and two girls. Presumably, she spoke to my sisters, and Dad was in charge of my brother and me. I don't know what he told my brother. I do know how he dealt with it with me. He took me on a drive in a car, which was very rare for us to spend time privately together. He didn't leave the house much. He just worked 10, 12 hours a day for many years. So for him to leave the house and ask me to accompany him was a pretty big deal. Dad also liked to talk. I mean, he talked a lot when he was around people. And this car ride was notable for his silence. And then he would begin a few to talk to me and just sort of sputter and stutter and trail off. And I didn't understand what was going on because this was so unlike Dad, who really loved to talk. And then we finally got back home, and he handed me a pamphlet on the reproduction of frogs. And yeah. So, which, you know, as for a 12, 13-year-old boy, it was very confusing. You know, the tadpole stage was, well, I don't really know how this fits into anything. But, you know, and I recount this in the book. There's something to me poignant and plaintive and quite unusual about a career pornographer who then was uncomfortable discussing sexuality with his son undergoing puberty.
Right. That must have been really confusing to you, too. How did your parents hide the porn books from you?
Well, Dad had an office in the house that was had been a bedroom on the second floor, and we were just forbidden to enter. All of us, nobody was allowed to enter it. The door was either closed or partially closed at all times. You had to knock to get admitted. You had to wait till Dad would allow you to come in. And that extended to my mother if she was bringing him coffee. I mean, you know, the key was don't disturb Dad when he's working. And so that's where it was. And now and again, when I was a kid, I would, of course, go in there when Mom and Dad were out of town and look around. But even in his office, and this was is still interesting to me. Even within his office, it was concealed, and I didn't realize it until after he died. There was he had two walls of built-in bookshelves that he had hired to put in there, and behind every row of books was another deeper and higher row of books that was pornography. So there was an element of it that was hiding it. Either from the family or the world or possibly himself.
Do you think that you grew up with this sense of secrets, you know, and that maybe even though you didn't know that the secrets pertain to sex and pornography that you somehow picked up on that anyways. I mean, I guess I'm wondering what impact it had on you to grow up with all this secrecy, mm-hmm. and especially since the secrets had to do with writing about sex.
Yes, there was an element of secrecy to it that I grew up with. I don't know what the impact would have been. I mean, Dad was, he was obsessed with sex, and he would talk about it, but obliquely, you know. He would often make jokes in a sort of a naughty style of comments and all. But there was still a pall of secrecy that hung over the house that that we all, you know, felt, or at least certainly I did. So as far as the impact, I'm not really sure, you know, other than it could have motivated me to write memoir, for example, which is the opposite of a pseudonymous secret writing.
Oh, that's
life.
True. That's a really good point. And I wonder how you feel about this forthcoming memoir about your father, because you will be exposing all the secrets he kept throughout his life, all the pseudonyms that he wrote under, everything that he hid from his family and from his neighbors.
Mm-hmm. How do I feel about it?
Yeah. Does it worry you that maybe your father would be upset? Or do you think your father would be happy that finally it can be revealed what a genius he was? You know, because I know he saw himself that way.
There was a part of me when I worked on it that, I mean, I worked on it pretty hard for a couple of years. And at times I would be concerned that I was betraying the big family secret. And I would talk to my siblings about it, and I talked to my mother about it, and, you know, they all pointed out the obvious, which was Dad's dead and you can't betray him. So I don't have any great concerns along those lines. As Mom said the other night, he would have loved the attention. Mm-hmm. And he liked attention. But there was some part of him that did not want to fully reveal the extent of this, of his output and his interest while he was alive. He started out as in sales for Procter & Gamble, traveling salesman to little country stores with Procter & Gamble products, then moved into selling health and life insurance. So sales relies on a great deal of self-belief. And I think that Dad incorporated into his writing life. I don't know that I've met anyone else who believed in himself as much as Dad did. And Dad fervently and absolutely believed that after he was dead, in the 21st century, he would be well-known and extremely famous for the pornography that he wrote under the name John Cleave. So to answer the question, how would he feel about it? Yes, you know, in a way, this book, to a certain extent, is fulfilling his own prophecy that he made about his legacy in the world. If it's true, I don't know if it'll be wind up true or not, but he would really have enjoyed it, yes.
So this is a question I've never asked anybody before. I've never had the occasion to.
Well, let me get ready here. This
ready?
Is going to be a first
okay.
for fresh so, air. All right.
So when you read your father's pornography mm-hmm. after he died, mm-hmm. I mean, the purpose of pornography is to be arousing. Mm-hmm. But when the author is your father, mm-hmm. is it possible to be aroused by it?
Not exactly. The fact that I was reading my father's work was always present in it. And the book actually deals with one chapter really examines very carefully the effect on me of a total immersion in pornography for 18 months. When I say total,
while you were writing the book.
Writing the book, going through it, cataloging 1,800 pounds of archival material, looking at it and just dealing with it. It was a little overwhelming to say the least.
What do you mean when you say overwhelming?
Well, you know, if you say you love chocolate and you wind up with a job in a chocolate factory, maybe you lose your taste for chocolate.
Got it.
The book talks about it pretty honestly about just the effects of it, and you know, they weren't all great.
Right.
The thing about Dad's work, though, is there's an innocence to it, if that makes any sense. There's a quaintness to it, in contrast to what is available on the internet, for example, now.
Right.
So this golden age of porn is also, it was taboo, it was underground, there was a tongue-in-cheek. A lot of Dad's stuff was funny, was satirical. And you just don't see anything like that today in terms of I'm not sure if there is mainstream porn. It seems like it's moved to the internet. But there's not a lot of humor or tongue-in-cheek or satire with it.
One more thing about your father, the pornographer. Your mother is still alive. She's in her early 80s now. Your father died in 2013. Can you talk to her openly about the collaboration they had where your father wrote the porn books and your mother typed the manuscripts? Is she comfortable talking about that?
She's very comfortable and open talking about it. I think for a couple of reasons. First of all, she's 80, and this was stuff that happened at least that wound down 30 years ago in her life. She also moved to Mississippi, where I live, and perhaps surprising to many people, Oxford, Mississippi is slightly more progressive than the town where she lived before, where she had greater concerns about this. She always referred to them with me as your father's sex books. That was how she saw them. And the last time we spoke, she expressed a little bit of a surprise at their popularity, because as she said, they were all the same. The same things happened, just different names and different venues. So the answer is yes, she is quite open to talking about it. And it's charmingly so. She is this 80-year-old Southern lady who lived all of her life in two counties in Kentucky and now can sort of reveal her own past, which there's a part of her that thinks is kind of cool.
Chris Offit, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Chris Offit is writing a memoir called My Father, the Pornographer. We spoke last March. Coming up, an interview with Larry David. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This episode of Fresh Air and the following message come from SimpliSafe Home Security, the smart way to protect your home or small business. SimpliSafe is a wireless security system with no annual contracts and around-the-clock protection. It's never been easier to make your home safe. Tech experts at CNET call SimpliSafe better, smarter home security. You can try this wireless alarm system, get a 10% discount, and show support for this show by visiting simplisafe.com/freshair. That's simplisafe.com/freshair.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, continuing our end-of-summer series featuring some of our favorite recent interviews from the past few months. Up next, an interview with Larry David. He co-created Seinfeld and created the HBO comedy series Curb Your Enthusiasm, in which he starred as a selfish, self-absorbed, misanthropic character named Larry David. How does that character compare with the real Larry David? That's one of the questions that Dave Davies asked when he interviewed Larry David last March, just before the opening of David's play, Fish in the Dark, which he wrote and starred in. The interview started with a short scene from the play. It's a comedy about the rivalries and dysfunction within a family. The family has gathered together after the father has died. His widow, played by Jane Houdyshell, is startled by something she's just seen. Her two sons are played by Ben Shankman and Larry David.
Mama, calm down. What is it?
It's a bird out there. You didn't see it? It was right there.
So what?
It was an Oriole. Daddy was from Baltimore. He was an Oriole fan. That was a sign from Sydney. He said he would give me a sign, and that was it.
Mama, you're crazy? Go put you in the nut house. It was just a bird.
It wasn't a bird. It was Sydney.
So I don't understand. What if it was Dad? Is that a good thing? Dad's a bird? Dad's a bird. It's a bird. It's a plane. It's Sydney. What a freak show.
Well, Larry David, welcome to Fresh Air. You play the lead in the play. People talk about taking themselves out of their comfort zone for a new challenge. Yeah. Was it that kind of thing for you? Because it sounds like you sure did.
Yeah, if you even have a comfort zone. Whatever comfort zone I had was pretty narrow. But this was definitely out of it for sure. Yeah.
You know, in Curb Your Enthusiasm, as I understand it, most of the dialogue was pretty much improvised. You would give all the actors an outline and then you'd improvise it. This must be very different working from a script. Was that hard?
Yeah, it is different. It's completely different. I have total freedom on Curb to kind of say and do anything I want. I can follow every impulse that I have. I'm allowed to interject when other people are talking. I'm kind of writing the scene as we're doing it. But this play is a different animal. You have lines. There are cues that are very important. You have to abide by the script. And the other actors don't like it if you get off of it either.
Do you do any vocal exercises before you start the play?
No. No, I probably should. I saw a bunch of the other actors on stage the other night, and they were warming up. And it just seemed like a silly exercise to me. You know, they do things with their lips. You know, they do that, and they stretch their mouths and do scales. But no.
There are a lot of really veteran theater actors in the cast. I mean, some really great performers. And
yes, it's a great cast.
It is. And I wonder if there are things about just theater culture that you've noticed and been surprised or intimidated or what anything by.
Well, there are some superstitions they have. Like, you're not allowed to whistle in the theater. And, of course, I've whistled a number of times because I'm an inveterate whistler. And I just always seem to forget. And boy, oh boy, do I get some bad looks when I do that from some of the vets. They don't like that one bit.
When I told my wife I was going to be interviewing you, she says, I want to know how that guy got the way he is. And, of course, she's assuming that guy is the guy she's seen on Curb Your Enthusiasm.
That doesn't sound so good to me.
We'll talk about whether that's how close that is to the real Larry David. But I do want you to tell us about like where you grew up. You grew up in Brooklyn. Tell us about the neighborhood.
I grew up in Brooklyn in in Sheepshead Bay. I lived right under the Belt Parkway. There were four buildings, which was my little universe. My friends, my 5, 6, 7, 8 friends, we all lived in this building, and it was a very happy childhood, as far as I remember. We played sports all the time, walked to school, played ball. In the winter, we'd play basketball in freezing temperatures, and every possible, we would invent games. And not too many girls in my life, I must say, though.
and what did your parents do?
My father was in the clothing business. He was a salesman. And my mother worked for the Bureau of Child Guidance.
As a social worker?
No, I think she did secretarial work.
Uh-huh. And did you have extended family in the neighborhood or in the building?
I did. I had aunts and my aunt and uncle and my cousins were right next door. My grandmother, my uncle, and my cousin were on the third floor. So there was no privacy. People were running in and out of the house all the time. Everybody knew your business. And then we also had relatives on Long Island where we'd go and see how rich people live. At the time, I thought they were rich because they didn't live in Brooklyn. I mean, yeah, they really weren't rich. They just lived in a house. To me, anybody who lived in a house was rich.
Did you have any sense of your future back then? Do you remember?
Just whatever it was, in my head, it was bleak. I don't remember having any ambitions, any goals, any dreams. It was always, how am I going to get by? What am I going to do? But I didn't really, to be honest, I didn't really give it much thought. Even in college, I didn't give it much thought. I was having fun in college, and basically when people asked me what I was going to do, I just said, something will turn up. What that was, I had no idea.
And did your parents have any particular expectation?
Zero. Zero expectations. My mother, I've said this before, she wanted me to work in the post office. She wanted me to be a mailman because she thought, I'd get a pension and I'd be taken care of. I would have security. And that was her dream. That was the best case scenario.
You were going to be Newman.
I was going to be Newman, exactly. Newman was very happy.
Right.
Newman is one of the happiest guys on television. Come on.
Right. He knows who he likes and who he doesn't. Yeah,
and the hours were good.
Right.
You know, they just dropped some mail off. It seemed like a decent job.
How did your parents react to your success?
They were quite stunned by it. When Seinfeld was the number one show in the country, my mother would call me up and go, Larry, do they like you? Do they think you're doing a good job? Are they going to keep you? What do they say to you? Do they tell you you're good? She was very insecure.
As I read about, your early life, one of the things that occurred to me is that, I grew up in a family. My parents didn't go to college. None of the people in my neighborhood went to college. And, I kind of managed to make a career and get on the radio, and I've been lucky enough to do the show from time to time and talk to people like you. But there's still a part of me that kind of doesn't believe in it. And people that I know that grew up in families where they were wealthy or their parents were public figures or university professors, they're just more comfortable out in the world and accepting that they are somebody. And I wonder, even after all you've accomplished, do you feel like you belong on the red carpet and, in magazines?
Not really. I completely understand what you're saying. It is a little odd. I'm somewhat detached from it. Like I'll see my name on the marquee and it doesn't really kind of register in any way. So I'm disassociated from it. But occasionally I do feel like a jerk. What am I doing here? Walking on the red carpet. These people obviously don't know me.
How did you get into comedy? You said you were in college having fun, no thought of a particular future.
Yeah, then I got out of college, and I was funny with my friends, and my friend's wife said to me, "You should be a comedian." And I thought, really, it just hadn't occurred to me. And then I went to the Improv to watch a show. As I'm watching the show, I'm starting to think that, hey, maybe Jane's right. Maybe I could do this. In fact, not only am I starting to think I could do it, I think I could be really funny up there. Not only that, I'm going to go up there right now. I go up to the owner of the club, Bud Friedman, and I say, I'd like to go on. Now, I'm just sitting in the audience on a Saturday night. I leave my seat, and I go talk to the owner. And I say to the owner of the club that I want to go on. And this is probably the most insane thing I've ever done in my life. And he said to me, who are you? I said, I'm just sitting in the audience. He said, no, you can't go on. Are you a comedian? I said, no. He said, no, you have to audition. And then if you pass the audition, then you could start going on. Thank God he said no, because had he said yes and I had gone up, it would have been a disaster. I may never walked up on a stage again for the rest of my life. But I started to put an act together, and then I went down to the Village, to a place called Gertie's Folk City, and I got on stage for the first time. A week later, I went to Gil Hodges' bowling alley in Brooklyn and got on stage for the second time. And then for the third time, I went to Catch a Rising Star, and I passed the audition, and then I started working out at Catch a Rising Star.
Well, we have a little piece of tape, and this is from Susie Essman, your friend, who, of course, appeared on Curb Your Enthusiasm. And she was at an appearance, and she was recalling her early days with you in stand-up. Let's listen.
Larry was a comic. Larry started as a stand-up comic, and I knew him from Catch a Rising Star. We probably met in 1985, 1986. And he was a legendary. He's what we call a comedian's comedian, meaning that he would get on stage and the comedians would stand in the back of the room. And Larry's on. We'd all come running into the room to watch him because you knew something brilliant and original was going to happen. But the audience half the time stared at him like they had no idea what the hell he was talking about. And he was very, very touchy. You know, sometimes if like the whole audience is laughing and you had a stomach ache and had a bad look on your face, that would be it. He'd storm off the stage. You know, or one time I remember I introduced him and, you know, ladies and gentlemen, Larry David, and he came on the stage and he just looked at the audience and he just went, never mind. And he just walked off. Just walked off. But his material was brilliant. He just never figured out that other thing of how to connect to an audience. That wasn't his thing.
And that's Susie Essman talking about our guest Larry David and his early days in stand-up. So does she have it right?
She's, yeah, that was pretty accurate. Yeah.
Do you remember the time you came in, looked at the audience, and walked off?
Yes, I do. I didn't say never mind. I think I said, I don't think so.
And why? I mean, what was it about the audience?
I didn't like the looks of them. I didn't like how they responded to the comic who was on before me. And I just didn't see that it was going to be a successful outing. So I decided to do a preemptive attack.
You know, when I heard this story and when I read about, I mean, how you struggled with stand-up and how all the comedians loved you, but audiences didn't always connect. And, you know, when you talk to people in show business, so many of them say, well, you know, I really want to follow my artistic voice and do interesting work, not just do what any schlock that's commercially successful. And when I look at your career, I mean, it strikes me that you actually did do that. I mean, you really did stick to what you believed in. And you found these vehicles, and it's an incredible success now because, I mean, it's a particular Larry David way of looking at the world and finding humor in it. And you did stick to your own vision, and it really worked. Is that how you see it?
Well, it didn't seem like I had much of a choice. I don't think that I don't think that my hand would have cooperated with my brain if my brain was telling my hand to write something it didn't really want to write. But I remember when there was some interference from NBC with Seinfeld when we first started doing it, and fortunately I didn't have a family at the time, so it was very easy for me to say to them, "No, I'm quitting. I'm not going to do that. I don't want to do that, and I can't do it." And for me, it wasn't a big deal to just pack up and go home. Like I said, I didn't have a family. It's much harder. That's the first piece of advice I'll give anybody who wants to get into this. Don't have a family for a while until you're successful, because it'll just make it very hard to ever get out of things, and you'll always have to compromise. But I didn't have to compromise because I didn't have a family.
And what was it NBC wanted you to do?
You know, they just didn't like the direction of the show. For example, the Chinese restaurant episode. They hated that show. They didn't even want to air it. You know, there was a big meeting about the kind of shows they liked and the kind of shows they didn't like. You know, I just said, well, I'm not going to be able to do that. So I just thought that I would quit. But then I learned another lesson, that when you say no, you invariably get your way. And it's a wonderful feeling. I can't believe I never did it before.
No, she's not going to do it.
Yeah, you just say no. And then they go, okay, well, you don't have to.
We're going to play a clip from Seinfeld, and there's a million we could choose, but I thought we would do one of Big Stein, George Steinberg.
Okay.
And, of course, people who know the show will know that there were many episodes where George Costanza worked for the New York Yankees, and he would be occasionally summoned to the office of the famous owner, George Steinbrenner, and you would do the voice. It would be shot from behind another actor, so you didn't actually see him. This is an episode, I think, in which Steinbrenner has summoned George because he's heard rumors about George's political views.
You wanted to see me, Mr. Steinbrenner?
Yes, George, I did. Come in. George, the word around the office is that you're a communist.
communist. I am a Yankee, sir, first and foremost.
You know, George, it struck me today that a communist pipeline into the vast reservoir of Cuban baseball talent could be the greatest thing ever to happen to this organization.
Sir?
You could be invaluable to this franchise. George, there's a southpaw down there nobody's been able to get a look at. Something Rodriguez. I don't really know his name. You get yourself down to Havana right away.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Do my best.
Good. Merry Christmas, George. And bring me back some of those cigars in the cedar boxes. You know, the ones with the fancy rings? I love those fancy rings. They kind of distract you while you're smoking. The red and yellow are nice. It looks good against the brown of the cigar. The Maduro, I like the Maduro wrapper. The darker, the better. That's what I say. Of course, the Claro's good, too. That's more of a pale brown, almost like a milky coffee. I find the ring size very confusing. They have it in centimeters.
And George Costanza has wandered out of the room. That's our guest, Larry David, as the voice of George Steinbrenner. It's funny, as we listen to that, it's not quite your speaking voice. You did some stuff there with that.
Well, hey, you know, Dave, I was doing an impression.
You're an actor.
Oh, sure. No, we brought in some people to read for Mr. Steinbrenner, and nobody really got it. And Jerry said, "Well, what are you looking for? How does it go?" And all of a sudden, I started talking like this. You know, he's a big blustery guy. He kind of talks like that. And Jerry said, "Yeah, you should do it. That's funny."
Did you ever hear how Steinbrenner himself reacted to the bit?
I think he liked it. Steinbrenner was unfamiliar with the show. His grandchildren watched it, and his grandchildren talked him into letting us use his name. The last episode, I think, of the 96 season, we came up with the idea to actually fly him in and put him on the show, because up to that point, we'd only been seeing the back of his head, and I was doing his voice, and then we thought it would be fun if he actually made a real appearance. So we called him up, and he said, yeah, he would do it. So we flew out to do it. He did the show. We started editing the show, and as I watched it, I'm going, oh, my God, this is not good. Because his acting was wanting, to say the least. So I had to call him up and tell him the news that he was being cut from the show. So I called Yankee Stadium, and I asked to talk to him. And then he got on the phone. I said, Mr. Steinbrenner, this is Larry David calling from the Seinfeld show. And he said, yes, Larry, what's going on? I said, well, Mr. Steinbrenner, you know, I watched the show. And he said, yeah, you can tell me. I'm a big boy. I said, well, it's not working. We have to cut you from the show. And he was actually okay with it.
Let's talk a bit about Curb Your Enthusiasm. And I want to begin with a clip. You're walking down the street in Los Angeles and spot your old friend Marty Funkhauser, who's played by Bob Einstein, and his mother has recently died. Let's listen.
Hey! Funkhauser! My God, I can't believe it. You're out? What are you doing?
This helps my emotions. Jogging is the best thing for me.
So mourners exercise. I didn't know that.
I don't know if mourners exercise. It's just good for me.
Interesting. I'm going to remember that next time I lose a close member of my family.
Yeah. Jogging.
Yeah.
Helps everything.
By the way, I called your house. I left a condolence message. I never got a return call.
Well, I had a few things on my mind.
Yeah, still. It's a little discourteous.
Let me explain something to you.
Sure.
I lost my dad a year ago. My mother just died. I'm an orphan, okay?
A what?
I'm an orphan.
Orphan?
Yeah, an orphan.
You're a little too old to be an orphan.
No, if you don't have parents, you're an orphan.
Oh, you could be 70 and be
an
orphan?
You could be 100 and be an orphan.
Oh, you can't be 100 and be an orphan.
Yeah, okay? You can.
Okay, little orphan Funkhauser.
That's our guest Larry David and Bob Einstein on Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Yes, I'm upset. Because he didn't respond to my call. He never returned my call.
A little discourteous.
I thought it was discourteous.
When I read about you, your friends say that you are actually a nice and generous person. Does it bother you that you've kind of created this image of yourself as this insensitive jerk?
Oh God, no, not at all. What? Why? No, because that's. Doesn't bother me in the least. I'm quite happy about it. I'm way closer to being the guy on Curb than the guy who's talking to you right now.
Really?
I know I'm often described as a nice guy, but By the way, I think the guy on Curb is a nice guy. He's just very honest.
Okay, okay. Well, the guy on Curb would probably think that the guy on Curb is a nice guy, but I don't know if that many other people would think that.
but why? Why isn't he nice? He's not mean. I don't think he's mean. I think he does nice things.
He just kind of can't let some things go that he might.
Yeah. Well, that doesn't mean he's not nice.
Okay. You know, I
think he's expressing a lot of the things that many people think about.
Right, but just are too inhibited to say.
Exactly.
You know,
that's why it's so much fun to do it.
Like a lot of your friends, Ted Danson has appeared on Curb Your Enthusiasm. And in 2009, he was in an interview on this show with Terry Gross. And she asked if any scenes in the series came out of your actual friendship with one another. And he told a little story. Let's listen to this.
When you go out to dinner with him, it's way scarier than acting with him because he's always pulling out his notebook. Or you don't know whether or not he's doing a scene in a restaurant and being a little louder than he should be because he's practicing something for next week, or whether this is truly Larry. It's a very scary kind of proposition, hanging out with Larry David.
I can imagine it would be a little embarrassing when he's talking too loud or doing something inappropriate, and you don't know whether he's testing a performance or just being weird.
We've sat in a restaurant, a very sweet, quiet inn, you know, New England inn, with a lot of people with kind of blue-gray hair. And he came in late, and his back was to the entire restaurant, but we were looking at the entire restaurant over his shoulder. And he was whispering this story in a kind of stage whisper that had the F word in it a lot. And he basically cleared the restaurant. And then as he's walking out, he went, "Nice restaurant. Little too quiet for a Jew, but it's a nice restaurant," and walked out. And it's like, and you kind of have to walk in his wake going, "Sorry, sorry, sorry. You know it's Larry. Sorry."
And that's Ted Danson talking about our guest, Larry David. Okay, Larry David, you don't sound so inhibited to me.
I don't think that story is accurate. First of all, I'm not practicing anything at the table, as was alleged. But yeah, I was particularly taken aback at how quiet that restaurant was that Ted Danson was referring to. And so I made a racket.
Just stirring the pot, yeah?
Yes. It was disturbingly quiet in there.
So maybe not so inhibited.
Well, not in that instance.
All right.
Brian. By the way, the character has emboldened me to be much less inhibited. If I'm at a dinner party and I want to go home, I can go before dessert. Okay, I've had enough. All right, I'm going to go. And nobody will be shocked to hear me say it, whereas I could never do that before Curb. And now people are not surprised, and they kind of expect it. Yeah, so that's great when I'm able to sort of emulate the character.
Larry David, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you, Dave.
Larry David spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies last March. Dave is also WHYY's senior news reporter. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is Adam Staniszewski. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.